photography lovers, and welcome to another episode of the Fashion Photography Podcast with me, your host, Virginia. It's time for part two of our episode with Carl Taylor, and yes, you can find part one on photographypodcast.net. There, we talked about many things, but today, we are starting right away with the conversation on how to pick the right mentor. We also talk about the steps to build a sustainable photography business, and actually, we talk a lot about business today. So, I believe you will enjoy a lot this podcast. But it's not just about business, don't worry. If you're here for a little bit of fun, Carl is telling us about the messiest shoot he ever had. Another very important topic is, do you need a big studio, and when exactly do you need it? It's going to be very entertaining, and I am sure you're going to enjoy it a lot. And if you do, don't forget to leave us an honest review on Apple Podcasts. And thank you so much in advance. Now, it's time for the podcast. Why don't we, right now, make a list of the things that we have to look for when we're choosing educational platform or a person who's going to mentor us?
Sure.
You can give an example, and then it's going to be my turn, and then it's going to be you again. I think it's going to be a cool list.
Yeah, that'd be fun. That'd be fun. Yeah.
So nice. We can make it a blog post afterwards.
Okay.
Okay. Who's going to go first?
I'll go first. I would say that the most important rule, in my opinion, when choosing someone that you want to learn from is have a look at what they've done and have a look at what they do. So, for example, I'm very proud of my own commercial work. So we have carltayloreducation.com, but my own commercial work is carltaylor.com. If anyone was to look at my own work, hopefully they would understand and appreciate that this guy knows what he's talking about. So I think the fundamental thing you should do if you're choosing someone as an educator is, do you respect the work that they turn out personally? Is it something that you like? Is the style of their work what you like? Does it seem that professional? Because if it doesn't, why would you choose to take information from that person?
Hmm. You sum it up too early. Yeah, I completely agree. I would say, of course, as you said, take a look at their work, but also take a look at the way they talk. Make your research. Do you make sure to take a look at the video or two of they talking if this is your type of person? Because I've been assisting too several years ago. I also been to university for photography. And I think it's very important to make sure, especially if we talk about education one-on-one, you have to make sure that this person is your type of person.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that personal relationship, even though you might be dealing with them via video or remotely, you have to feel connected to the way they explain things. Mm-hmm. Because this can be the other problem with education. You can have someone that has all the knowledge and has good work, but then they're terrible at explaining.
Absolutely.
You're absolutely right. You need to have that as well. You have to have that personal connection, and the way they explain things and the way they talk has to resonate with you so that you feel you're willing to listen to them and not get confused by what they're saying.
Absolutely.
The next one, I suppose, would also be to do with how the information is presented, not just verbally, but how it's presented visually. And we make a real strong effort with what we do to either have multiple camera angles or have one wide camera, one close-up camera, anything that we talk about where we describe something that's very particular or small is I'll make sure that a cameraman gets in there and shows what we're talking about. So as well as verbally and audibly understanding what your presenter is saying, I think it's also important that visually the edit of the training or the live filming, the cameramen filming also appreciate and understand what the audience need to see to better understand visually what's happening.
Totally agree with that. Super important, especially when we talk about visual stuff to learn. They got to be presented the right way.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
I would say don't look at their following numbers, because in my opinion, not every educator have the biggest following.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be very good at explaining, and they might not be that well known, but they will know what to say and how to say it. So if you take a look at the previous points that we mentioned, now is a moment to just not look at their following numbers. If they're checking the previous ones, that's fine.
Absolutely. Yeah. The previous ones we've just mentioned are the most important. And if you tick a box for each of those, then it doesn't matter how popular they are, mm-hmm. as long as they fulfill those criteria that we've just spoken about.
If you don't have anything to mention, I have another thing on my mind.
Yes, go for it.
I think you should take a look at their history. So if these people are people that are thriving to get the knowledge and succeed in what they do, you're definitely going to see a very big curve from their very first photo shoots to the recent ones.
Mm-hmm.
And you will see how they're building up. If they're building up, I think it's a great sign that they're going to help you do the same.
Yeah. And my final one, which I think is the most important, is if you think back to when you were at school, I can guarantee you or any of your listeners that the subjects that you enjoyed the most were the ones where your teacher was passionate and enthusiastic and really excited about what they were teaching. Because if you have the right teacher who has the passion and the enthusiasm, it becomes addictive. You share that enthusiasm and passion amongst the students. And it's really important that your presenter has that passion still, has that enthusiasm. Because if they've got the knowledge and they've got the skills, but they don't have the passion, enthusiasm, then you don't feel the energy. And you need to feel the energy so that it builds excitement in you and makes you feel passionate about doing it as well. So I think that's really, really important. And, you know, I say anyone can remember from school their favorite school teachers, and it was usually the ones that had passion about what they were doing. You could feel it. You could sense it.
Absolutely. I love that. And as a final one on my side, I would say that they should know a little bit more than just photography, because today we talk about business.
Mm.
They don't need to be marketing expert or business experts, but they should know how to give you the basic knowledge. And from then on, you can find the right resources. You can find the right people to ask particular questions. But I think they should know a little bit more, because there are many photographers out there that are great as photographers, but sometimes their business is struggling. So I think an educator like this should know just a little bit more.
It's a very good point, because as you just mentioned, there are photographers who can have fantastic skills, exceptional portfolio, but they're struggling because they're not knowing how to communicate to the right potential clients, or they're not understanding how to market themselves. And obviously, as photographers, most photographers are self-employed.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter whether you're a photographer or a chef or a carpenter, you're still running a business, and you have to know a little bit about business and how to market yourselves to compete. You also need to be realistic about the market as well. The economics of business comes down to supply and demand. How much supply is there? And how much demand is there for what you're supplying? Those are the two fundamental parts of establishing a business, or even deciding to establish a business, because it doesn't matter how good you are. If no one knows about you, then you won't sell anything. Or if everyone knows about you and you're really good, but no one needs it, you're also not going to succeed. And that's all to do with supply and demand. So as well as having good work, you really need to appreciate that issue of supply and demand, in that what I'm selling, is that anyone actually want to buy it?
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar to what I say in some workshops, is where if you open a restaurant in the city or the town, and it's the most amazing Italian restaurant, it's got the best food, the best chef or whatever, but there are already 25 other Italian restaurants in the same street, then it might not work.
Yeah.
This is the difficulty with it. So not only do you have to have an amazing restaurant, an amazing food. You also have to have really good marketing to beat those other 25 restaurants. You have to think very cleverly how you're going to do it. You have to actually be careful before you even make the decision in thinking, is there enough space in the market for another Italian restaurant in this city? Or should I be thinking about relocating somewhere else? Or should I be thinking about a French restaurant instead of an Italian restaurant? These are just fundamental supply and demand issues that often photographers forget. And part of the reason they forget it is because most photographers are very much art orientated. So in many ways, people that are art orientated are less business orientated than other people that work for themselves. And I think that's where and why sometimes photographers starting out with a business, they often come into problems.
I completely agree. Actually, this is, in my opinion, also one of the reasons why many people are just quitting their business, because they don't have the ability to make it a real business. They're starting with it and they think that it's going to be enough to just produce photography. And this is not enough. Many people think it's easy. And it's really not easy. It takes a lot of money, even.
Yes.
To build a sustainable business.
Huge amount of work. When I stopped doing photojournalism, I worked as an assistant. And I did a lot of assisting work in commercial studios. And that's where I became interested in advertising, commercial photography, and lighting. And then when I opened my own business, I had to borrow a large amount of money from the bank to purchase the lighting and the equipment and large format cameras. I started off in a very small studio space to begin with. And then over the years, gradually, I'm now on my fifth studio and I've got this great big studio, but there's no way I would have been able to start with this studio. I started small. I started with brochures and portfolios. I was up till 2 a.m. doing mail shots and putting brochures and envelopes, and I was building database lists of art directors and calling them and having postcards printed and mailing to them. I had 5 or 6 big acrylic bound portfolios made, and I had couriers deliver those to different ad agencies and different art directors for a week. And then the courier would collect it and then take it to the next one. Huge amount of marketing and expense to do it. And then following all of those portfolio couriers, following all of those up with a telephone call to the art director saying, hey, did you get my portfolio that I had dropped and delivered to you? Did you get a chance to look at it? I'd love the opportunity to come in and talk to you. Be great if we could have a meeting. So you can't just rely on having an Instagram account or a website, because that isn't going to cut it at all. So the amount of work that you have to put in to the business side and making personal connections is very important to the success of your business. And I think if you're not willing to do that, you have to do one of two things. You have to either ask yourself whether maybe this isn't the right thing for me, or two, you need to have an agent, or you need to have a marketing person that works for you part-time that will take care of that side of the business for you, because otherwise you won't get anywhere.
Yeah, there is a decision for everything. You just have to think about it and find it eventually. Because I joke about it, but it's not really a joke. Usually when you're a photographer, it takes like about 2% of your whole effort to shoot. Because that's the whole thing. It's a business. So people should have the business in mind when they're stepping into this.
Yeah, totally. And you've got to be prepared, if you're working for yourself, to do your invoicing, to do your accounts, to do your marketing, to do your deliveries, your pickups and everything else, your post-production. And, you know, this wonderful fantasy of shooting 8 hours a day and hanging out with cool people is never the reality of working as a photographer.
Yeah. And it's never just that easy. You usually have to, as you said, assist or do something else, like go to a mentor or educate yourself,
yeah,
like by yourself or thanks to someone. And it's a very, very long list of things you have to do in order to become this name.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like there is nothing that you can miss.
Yeah, you have to think of every aspect of it, really.
Yeah, so One of the aspects is the studio, especially in your case when you're shooting products. Mm. And you've got this gorgeous big studio right now.
Yeah.
So tell me, I'm just taking a big turn right now.
Yeah, sure.
What was the photo shoot when you created the biggest mess in the studio? And I am very sure that I know the answer.
I think you probably do. We create a lot of mess in the studio, and we've done a lot of very messy shoots that have involved water, paint, liquids, models flying through the air and all sorts of stuff. But the biggest mess was when we were commissioned by Hasselblad for the launch of the H6 camera. And they asked me to undertake a photo shoot that incorporated the color orange, because the Hasselblad H series cameras had this new orange shutter button. So they said, look, as long as it's got the theme orange in it. And I said, well, can I come up with the idea? And they said, yeah. Presented it to them, and they said, yeah, and we had to make a video as well. And this was a huge shoot with lots of assistants and lots of tins of paint. And we had all of these contraptions that looked like ski ramps, so that we could let the tins of paint slide down the ski ramps and take off in the air, and then collide with another tin of paint that was coming from another ski ramp and another one from another ski ramp. And we had to get all the timing correct, so that essentially these tins of paint smashed into each other at the exact right place and space, so that it was in line with where the focus point was and where the lens was and the lighting was. And it just took so many goes and so many times till we got the perfect splash. And we were using sound triggers so that the camera fired the lights at the moment when the tins collided. And then we had to adjust the sound trigger delay time so that it wasn't shooting too early when the tins collided, or so that it waited a few thousandth of a second later, so till some of the paint was coming out of the tins, etc. And we just had mess everywhere. I mean, it was like a 4-day shoot. There was paint. We were all covered in paint. There was paint over the walls, paint everywhere. I think it took us 2 days to clean up from that shoot.
Oh my God.
And then we did another shoot recently, a charity shoot for a marine pollution awareness campaign. And that shot was of a baby sat with a hypodermic needle in all of this plastic pollution and rubbish. And we had all of this rubbish from the ocean that these volunteers had collected that we turned into a piece of art, essentially, as a studio, with this baby sat in this valley of rubbish. And that was a 1 week project, and with a lot of mess and a lot of clear up. But we were particularly proud of that shoot because it got a lot of attention globally. It had 1 million views on the BBC News website. It was taken up by a lot of the major environmental organizations, used it. A lot of scientists around the world used the image in their presentation. We made the images freely available for anyone involved in marine pollution campaigns to use them. It was a really good project. And the image actually was nominated for the Prix Pictet Award as well, which was nice. Didn't get into the finalists, but it was nice to be nominated, because you can't enter that award. You have to be nominated for it. Mm-hmm. So that was nice. So yeah, we do a lot of messy shoots. And I think the reason for that is because we have the space to do them now. In our previous studio, I mean, I've been in this studio for nearly 5 years. Previous studio was only about a third of this size. And we did do some very messy shoots in that studio, but it was a lot more difficult to do because that studio was on the first floor. So, you know, even just getting the mess out of the building and things like that was more difficult. So, yeah, it is a lovely luxury having a big space that we've got now. And this is something that comes up. Photographers come to me and say, oh, it's amazing. You've got this huge studio space. You know, I wish I had that huge studio space. And I said, look, guys, when I started in photography, my studio was smaller than the kitchen there. You know, so don't think that I started like this. It didn't, you know, this is the fifth studio that I've had in my 25 years. And they started very small and then gradually got a little bit bigger, a little bit bigger, and a little bit bigger as we won more clients, more jobs. And then with the education business, we also needed more space for filming and for video elements as well. So it didn't start with a really huge studio. started with a really small studio and a smaller client base. And just through a lot of work, it's gradually grown bit by bit, which is how most businesses do grow. You know, it's a gradual thing. It's not instant. I think one of the problems is that sometimes new photographers look at successful photographers and they go, wow, look at that. I wish I had all that. But they have to remember that none of us ever started like this. You know, mm-hmm. We started small and grew.
It's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
And by the way, guys, you can take a look at all of the images that we mentioned on carltaylor.com. We've linked it on photographypodcast.net in our show notes, where you will also be able to see linked the video with the pin we talked about. And I saw the video several times because I've seen it before, and I saw it when I was preparing for the interview. And I must say, you were so calm at the moment when they were shooting you. I wasn't sure if there was a tear in your eye. But if it was me, I would have been crying until the end. I'm really crazy about keeping the mess very far away from me. And while we were on the topic of big studios, as you said, many people want to have this luxury, but I'm not very sure that they know what to do when they're in a big studio.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I mean, most of the things that I photograph from a commercial perspective, like product photography, whether it's sunglasses or alcohol or electronics, I don't need a big space to do that. I could do it in a quarter of the size. I mean, it is actually surprising. Sometimes small objects do need more space than you realize.
Yeah.
You could still do it in a much, much smaller studio than this. So the reason we have a bigger studio like we have now is because we run workshops here, we do filming here, we also rent the studio space out. But for many of the shoots that I do, we certainly don't use all of the studio space. And yeah, many photographers go into a big studio and they wouldn't know what to even do with the space. But I think what you have to do is, when you go into any photo shoot, is just simply pre-visualize what it is you're trying to do. And I use the process of drawing the photo shoot out, drawing the subject, sketching, and then writing down my notes of like, I want light here. And then you start to visualize in your mind what you're going to need and what you're going to use. And you can almost calculate the space you're going to need based on your pre-visualization. So that's always a good way of working out what space you would need if you've got to rent a studio. Because remember, a lot of photographers now don't even own their own studios. Many of them just rent studios when they need them.
Absolutely. Yeah, I do have a home studio, which is a small studio, and then I rent when I need something bigger.
Exactly. And I'm sure when you're thinking about one of your fashion shoots and you're thinking about the set or the amount of space, by pre-visualizing the shoot, you can kind of work out how big a studio you're going to need to rent.
Absolutely. I always draw. But yeah. I think it's also a big advantage if you know how light works. If you're at the very beginning and you want to go to a big studio, you're going to be very frustrated.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
In a bigger space, light is acting differently.
Right, totally. Yeah. It doesn't bounce around in the big space the same way because of the inverse square law.
Mm-hmm.
The light's got a further distance to travel. So the change in contrast of the light is affected quite a lot, from bounce light off of the walls. Whereas in a small studio space, the light can actually become a problem because it bounces around too much.
Mm-hmm.
So in small studio spaces, it can actually be advantageous if the studio can be blacked out so that it has black curtains on the walls or the ceiling so that you can actually get rid of any bounce light if necessary. There's a number of different tricks you can apply depending on the size of the studio. But if you don't understand light, especially understand the inverse square law of light, then you will struggle to know what to do in different size studios with your lighting.
Yeah, so it's always good to appreciate your level of knowledge, I think. If you're starting right now and you need a smaller space, or this is what you can have, just appreciate it.
Be
very observant, take a look at what's going on, just try to absorb every single piece of knowledge that you can.
Yeah, which is why working as an assistant is always a great place to start for those people that, you know, want to get in photography. It's obviously difficult to get assisting jobs even, But if you end up assisting for a good photographer, you will learn an awful lot in a year. That's a very good way of that sort of observation. And I think that's what we try to do with our education platform, is present our training in a way as if you were the assistant on the shoot, so that you have that experience of knowledge as if you were assisting the photographer.
That sounds just awesome. And also another tip, I have also done this as a photographer when people are approaching me to be assistant and I don't need assistance at the moment.
Mm.
They have offered to pay to me and be with me in the studio for a day and just for me to act like their mentor and just guide them through the process. I think this is also very, very helpful, especially if you can do it several times with the same or different photographers. I think it's going to be very helpful too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are, I mean, photographers like Rankin, he uses assistants and he does internships where they won't get paid, but they'll get maybe a month or 2 months assisting work so that they can get the experience. That is sometimes an option if you can afford it as an assistant, that you're willing to work for free for a month just for the experience. That can be valuable to you. And then sometimes that can actually lead to getting you work as well if you prove yourself as an assistant. One of the common questions I get asked about people wanting to be assistants is, you know, what they should do and what they should know. And I always say that the more skills you have, the more you can upsell yourself. Like, for example, if you're going to work as an assistant, most assistant work is moving lights, changing exposure on light settings and doing what the photographer's telling you and holding this and holding that. But if you can also say to the photographer, well, look, you know, I'm a brilliant digital retoucher or digital operator, and I know the software for that camera, and I know Photoshop and that. If you've got other skills that you can bring to the party, then you're going to make yourself more valuable and more useful and potentially more employable. So it's always worth thinking about that when you're going for an assistance job, because the more assets you can bring to it, then the more you'll be appreciated.
This is great advice. I love that. If you're really interested in assisting, next week we'll continue with this topic and we'll tell you how to become the best assistant out there. So don't forget to come back another Wednesday. But before that, there is a Friday episode, because, you know, every Wednesday we're here with a guest and every other Friday I'm answering your questions and I'm also giving you some tips and tricks. So come over on Friday. And if you have a particular question that you want to hear the answer of, post it in our Facebook group called Fashion Photography Lovers. Or if you're too shy, you can just go to photographypodcast.net and send us an email from there. I cannot wait to see your suggestions. And thank you so much, guys, for being with us today. I'll see you on Friday.